This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Violet Microphones, on the web at violetusa.com, and by Omnia Audio, world leader in audio processing, on the web at omniaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert.
We've covered AM, FM, and this show, it's HD.
We're still cranking the crank and making the sausage right now.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
Yeah, I have all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And the usual cast of characters, including Chris Tarr, Chris Tobin, and from Ibiquity, its engineer, Jeff Detweiler.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello and welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and very glad to have you along. This is the show where we talk about radio technology. And we can talk about anything from the stylus and the vinyl turntable, through the audio console, microphones, CD players, digital playout systems, digital recording, audio processing. A lot of that's been going on, and transmission systems. So welcome into our show. This show is episode number 29, and this show is really going to be interesting for a lot of folks. We're going to talk about HD radio, which applies mostly to the U.S., but HD radio is in other countries as well. Now, tonight, our co-hosts going to join us are from New York City, Chris Tobin. Hello, Chris. Welcome in.
Thank you, Kirk. How are you?
Oh, there I am. I'm good. I'm good.
Excellent.
Good to have you from Manhattan. And Chris Tobin is going to be able to ask a lot of good questions of our guest about HD radio, since, Chris, you take care of a number of HD stations, don't you?
We have six HD stations. For disclosure, I'm employed by the CBS Radio Corporation. So, yes, we have a lot of HD here in Manhattan.
All right. And also with us, another guy with some HD from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's Chris Tarr. Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm doing good, Kirk. How are you?
Man, you're looking good tonight. That lighting is super duper.
Well, you know, I moved away from the sheet from last week, so we're in better shape now.
Okay. And myself, well, I'm employed by the folks at Telos Omnia and Axia, so there's my disclosure for you. And yes, Telos Omnia and Axia do sell equipment that is used with HD radio, so I'm sure our company has been... if not promoting HD's use in particular, we sell equipment that makes its use more easy. Now, we've been doing a foundation series of technology. We've discussed in depth AM modulation, amplitude modulation, so AM broadcasting. We've discussed frequency modulation in some good depth as well. And so next, we're going to talk about some digital transmission. Not that there are different kinds of digital transmission. The one we're going to talk about on our show today is a very popular one, and it's HD radio. So joining us is Jeff Detweiler. Hello, Jeff. Are you with us?
I am, Kirk. How are you tonight?
I'm good. Jeff, seems like I've known you since maybe just before you joined Ibiquity Corporation. I was looking through my notes here, and seems that you and I did some meetings together, SBE meetings, back in 2000. So that's been 10 years that I've actually known you, and I see you typically at the shows, showing off some of the HD radio offerings. Jeff, why don't you kind of give us a little quick overview of what is Ibiquity and what do you do there, and then we'll start getting into some HD radio tech questions.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Well, I've been with the company about 10 years. I joined Ibiquity Digital in 2000. At that time, it was a company known as USA Digital Radio. Ibiquity was the resulting company from a merger of USA Digital Radio and Lucent Digital Radio, two proponents of in-band, on-channel digital broadcast technologies. And my experience with digital solutions for radio goes back many years prior to that, when I was working with a small transmitter manufacturer called QEI Corporation, and we were one of the manufacturers involved in some early amplifier prototypes used for transmitting then test signals, and got to know the folks and came on board as the broadcast technology rollout manager. Quickly moved from that role after a couple of years of putting a plan in place to working on the technology side, and got involved in the actual testing and development of the system. So I'm a survivor after 10 years and, you know, bad economies and the current state of the industry. But I'm happy to be here and happy to be involved in this project. HD radio is something that I came into as a bit of a skeptic and honestly became a real believer in the technology, and I still am. I think it's a great tool for the industry. You know, like anything else that comes along, it's not going to be the be-all and end-all. It's going to still require great programming to make this a commercial success for everyone. But those things are coming along right now, and we're starting to see the technologies learning to use the new legs they have. So I can give you a little bit of an overview of the technology if you'd like, and
Jeff, I know a lot of our listeners are a little bit interested in how the technology got to be where it is, because it's both a technology and it's also the result of a bit of politics with that are rather particular to U.S. broadcasters and how they wanted to protect their turf with a technology that would let them use their existing license to transmit digitally. And I know that there were a few different ways tried to make that happen. And then it seems like I was, an active participant, or I should say an active observer to the development of the technology back when it was Acorn and USA Digital Digital Radio. So why don't you just give us your quick couple of minute overview of how things got started and why they evolved the way they did into, you know, some people say HD radio technology currently, we could have had a better system. And some people say, no, it's a really good system, just exactly the way it is. And here's why. But kind of get us through the early years and get us to where to how the decisions were made to make it the way it is.
Well, a lot of that history, as you know, I said earlier, kind of began even before my arrival. I think the true beginnings of the technology go all the way back to about 1992. Then Project Acorn, which was a group of broadcast groups that got together, as you indicated, looking for a way to allow their technology to survive in a world where it was seeing competition from a proposal for satellite radio at the time, and seeing other digital media starting to take root. We had CDs coming on board. Radio was constantly being challenged by the cassette, the CD, the future satellite radio technologies, things that were threats that were going to challenge their story on Wall Street. And these broadcasters got together to look at a way to move their technology into the next generation. And there, as you pointed out, there were a number of different types of technology that were looked at. Many of the early efforts focused on spread spectrum using the subcarrier region rather than the adjacent spectral areas. And one of the problems with using spread spectrum in that type of an area of the band, or I should say of the channel spectrum, it resulted in a lot of susceptibility to noise. And as a result, any multipath, any noise would cause the system to unlock, and it didn't behave very well in a mobile environment. So it wasn't really until around 1998 when the project moved off of spread spectrum, and I think there was a pretty bad demo that went down at NAB, and as a result,
oh, yeah.
They began looking at something completely different, and to borrow from Monty Python. And we started looking at OFDM as a frequency modulation for the HD radio signal. And at that time, it was under a trade name IDAB, and that was held on to until the merger with Lucent Digital Radio. But each of the companies that resulted in Ubiquiti Digital, that being USA Digital Radio and Lucent Digital Radio, each had similar but slightly different approaches. And those times when we merged were a little bit tenuous in the company, quite honestly. We looked at really the best of the best and tried to put together a system that borrowed from each company's unique perspectives. And we went through about a year-long period of cross-pollinating the two groups. Some of our guys went there. Some of their guys went down to our facility. And we ended up having a really solid team that developed. You know, it took time, but I think overall we ended up with a much better product than either one of the companies could have produced on its own. So, you know, from that perspective, I think, you know, the consumer and the broadcaster really benefited from the merger. So really at that point, we went into a full test and development phase. There was a slightly challenging period where the industry wasn't quite in tune with our codec choice. We had a different codec in the system at that point. We got into a long and drawn out shootout, but once again, the net result was I think we ended up with a benefit for the industry with a codec that offers a really superior signal in many respects to the path that we had originally chosen. It was a good choice. It was a little bit disruptive, and ultimately we spent more time doing that than we wanted to. But you know, for the consumer, there is definitely a benefit.
Jeff, I know that the codec you guys ended up choosing, you had some custom design in that for you, and I think you ended up making a very good choice because the codec really does sound good, even at some moderate bit rates like 48 kilobits per second. I've got an HD radio in my car, and sometimes I don't always listen to it. Sometimes I listen to podcasts. When I do listen to it, I'm always amazed at how clear the audio is from the HD signals, as long as the station is processing the audio appropriately for that channel. And certainly some stations haven't understood the technology yet, and they're using older audio processing ideas to process for their HD streams. But boy, there are some stations out there that really sound good on the HD, that they're more open, there's less, you know, high-end fatigue. The bass is just awesome because it's digital. You don't have the problem of an FM modulator as not acting properly with the bass like you do on analog stations. So anyway, there definitely are some benefits. And one of the things I really enjoy is in the Nashville market where I live, nobody does this. But in some other markets, I've scanned across the HD dial and heard some programming that's pretty intriguing. Like there was an all-comedy station I was listening to in Memphis. And this, I had to go into a store and I stopped and I listened and listened and listened until the comedian was done. And of course, then they put on somebody else good. So I had a hard time getting out of the car and going in the store. But enough about the content choices. Some people are complaining that, hey, it's just regurgitated content from what the station has been doing before. But there are some stations that are doing some interesting content on HD. So Jeff, we're going to want to get into some real technical questions for a little while and then give you an opportunity to kind of tell us where things are as far as the transmission end and, more importantly, the receiver end, which is where it all comes down to for consumers. Some of the things that kind of confuse me about the HD tech, Jeff, are exactly what is going on with the transmission. I know you've got upper side bands and lower side bands from an FM signal. And you've got a number of little FM carriers there that all kind of seem to work together to transmit this data. Can you give us some facts and figures and some idea of modeling of what's going on this transmission?
Well, certainly I'd be happy to. And I was just thinking, gee, I really am at a loss here not having a bunch of good pictures to show you, but that's
primarily it's an audio podcast. So if you make a good audio description, then we'll get it. The video here is really kind of ephemeral, but the audio podcast is what sticks.
All right. Fair enough. We'll begin with the FM system and just talk about that a little bit. We use orthogonal frequency division multiplexing. The carriers are on either side of the analog signal in a hybrid mode where we transmit them adjacent to the analog spectrum. In the case of the hybrid system, there are 191 OFDM carriers that are in the what we call the P1 partition. This is the first grouping of carriers that are used in mode MP1, which is the standard hybrid mode. This mode does not have any of the extended carriers in there. It is basically redundant information in the upper and the lower sideband. So either sideband can survive totally on its own. And if you have both, you get a code gain as well as a power gain. So it's a benefit to have both, but if you don't, you can fully recover the signal as long as it's not in a severe type of interference. The primary partitions use a 1/2 code rate. I'm sorry, 2/5 code rate on the primaries. The extended partitions, we use a 1/2 code rate. The carrier grouping in the extended partitions adds an additional 76 OFDM carriers to the group. So we've got a lot of little digital signals running around there. As I mentioned, the system here in the United States is deployed with redundant sidebands. And in Europe, we are now actually proposing a number of changes for ETSI standard, which would hopefully be adopted around the world. China, Brazil, Mexico are all showing interest in the technology, and for the very simple reason this technology does not displace the existing analog radios. And that's a pretty strong motivator. As with most of the digital technologies out there, they're looking to either move into new spectrum and shut off analog services. Ours is one of the few technologies that allows it to coexist with the existing spectrum. So we think that's a pretty strong case. But as far as the waveform, the hybrid mode has two different configurations. The primary main MP1 mode has the P1 partition illuminated. The upper and lower sidebands carry redundant information. These are OFDM carriers. Each one of the sidebands can stand on its own. Another unique aspect about how it is deployed, the upper and lower sidebands are spectrally inverted from each other so that common interference originating from frequency center won't hit the same information at the same time. Or if there is a signal moving through, it won't be able to spectrally hit the same areas at the same time. So selective fading and things like that are not a problem for HD radio technology.
Now, Jeff, a lot of people have experienced fading on FM if they pull up to a stoplight listening to an FM station, and the station maybe they're just inching up and the station goes away or gets weak or gets real distorted, and you pull your car forward another 6 inches or a foot and everything comes back okay. So that's selective fading brought on by multipath. And the digital signals can suffer the same effect, but you're saying since there's redundant signals above and below the carrier, I've seen this on a spectrum analyzer in a moving vehicle, a demo that back then USA Digital Radio did. And as we drove around, you could see the digital sidebands go up and down and up and down. So I guess the receiver is choosing the data from the sideband that's working. Is that right?
Well, and in many cases, it uses the data from both sides. And as I mentioned, when we're able to recover both the upper and lower sidebands, there's not only a code gain, but a power gain in the receiver with that recovered data. So there's a benefit to having both sidebands there if you can transmit them. In Europe, because the frequency allocations are a little bit tighter.
The webcam.
Uh-oh.
Sorry about that. Continue, Jeff.
Okay.
Go ahead.
In Europe, because there is spectral differences between the U.S. market and the European markets in protection ratios and in the channel spacing, we have an option to reduce one sideband significantly, even beyond what we do in the U.S. Under this new configuration that we're considering. But we can also operate single sideband. And the advantages are that we can fit into much tighter spacing scenarios. It has less robustness than the U.S. system when you have both sidebands present, but we can then also change the code rates. So we have a lot of flexibility in the design. Those who have felt that we were, trying to put a U.S. system into Europe, I think haven't really taken a look at what we're doing. I would encourage them to explore it a little more deeply. But, there's a lot of challenges when you're dealing with putting digital signals into the presence of analog signals. There's
The folks in the chat room asking about interference from adjacent channel stations, and how does that work out, and how can it get mitigated if it's bad enough to be noticeable?
Well, I guess the question is, are they asking about digital interference to the analog or analog to the digital? Both are a concern, and they were really paramount concerns when we designed the system. We operated with a do no harm philosophy, and as many of you in the U.S. are aware, we started out with a power level of the sidebands at 23 dB down per sideband, which is a total integrated power of minus 20 dB. And recently just received approval to raise that power to minus 14. And that was done because the broadcaster said, you know, there's just not any interference out here that, you know, has been significant. And they petitioned the FCC for the increase. And we believe it's a good move. There's about 40 stations, I understand, that have gone up in power. And fortunately, we haven't seen, any of the predicted interference from our, you know, those detractors. But the advantage of the digital system with redundant sidebands, if we're talking about analog as an interfere, if an adjacent channel is interfered with, you can recover the signal cleanly for the upper sideband. Typically speaking, you don't see both sidebands hit at the same time.
Jeff, help us understand this thing about the power in the sidebands. Let's imagine that just for a nice big round number, let's imagine a 100,000 watt FM radio station. And if under the older provisions, the total power in the digital sidebands could be minus 20 dB from the power of the FM station. What does that work out to in terms of watts? And maybe Chris and his other brother Chris could give us some real world examples of what they have experienced at their places. What does this power level mean, and is it enough to penetrate some of the buildings they want to get into? And then they can talk about some interference too. But Jeff, kind of give us an overview of what this means in terms of power for a 100 kilowatt FM station.
Surely. In simple terms, the original deployment of the system operating at minus 20 was 1% of the analog power. So if you had a 10 kilowatt station, it was 100 watts of digital.
Wow,
the proposal, it's hardly anything. That's the reason you don't see much interference from it. The proposal for minus 10 would have brought that to 10% of the power, and we ended up with minus 14. So we're, our studies all showed that in free space, the coverage at minus 14 pretty much equals the analog signal. Now, when you get into building penetration questions, this is where having those additional a few watts of power will help quite a bit. The typical stick-built structure will attenuate the signal somewhere between 6 and 10 dB. So simply stated, if you were to measure the signal outside and then come inside, it will be perhaps 10 dB lower inside the building. It's not surprising that if you can get it outside and then you go inside and you can't, a power increase of 10 dB to compensate for that would typically work.
And that's no different from using your cell phone. It works outside and doesn't work inside.
Correct.
Because, concrete and steel to have this attenuation property on certainly cell phone frequencies, and but less so on FM frequencies, but still there too. Hey, Chris Tobin, talk to us about power increases there. And if you have any questions for Jeff, go ahead and
We haven't implemented any power increases yet because we're on a master antenna system at the Empire State Building, and we're among many broadcasters, so we just can't flip a switch and go to it without getting everybody upset. So we're still operating at the current levels. So our carriers are at about 890 watts leaving the top of the Empire State Building and hopefully penetrating most places. But some of the buildings, we do have problems with reception, as Jeff pointed out. It's to be expected. For the most part, though, it actually works very well. One question I do have that I get a lot from folks who come by our facility inquiring about the HD radio technology is the cost to implement. I don't have an exact number because our facility is slightly different and it's not the same, I'm sure, as many others across the country as size is concerned. Is there a template or some way for a broadcaster who's looking to implement HD can at least get an idea for budgetary purposes? What's it going to cost me to invest? Let's see, my investment costs, return on investment, all the wonderful financial numbers. Do you have anything like that?
I could certainly help you give you some ballparks here.
Ballparks would be great.
Basically, back when we were first implementing the technology, it was a little more expensive. Typically, a digital exciter was in the neighborhood of about $25,000 to $27,000. You would then need to have a transmitter that was sized appropriately. That transmitter, you know, could cost anywhere from probably $60,000 to $160,000, depending upon the power level. So it's going to be difficult to give you an accurate range that fits all, but for a typical Class B facility, I would say that you're probably into about $125,000, typically okay. speaking, for a conversion. The licensing fee for HD on the U.S. For a broadcaster is a one-time fee for the main channel. And there's currently a special deal. I think that the current rate here in 2010 is $25,000 as a one-time fee, and it is across all station sizes. But there is a special deal right now that if you sign up right now, I think the current license fee is $10,500. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
So there's a special deal. I mean, we realize that the economy has hit everyone, and we're trying to keep things, you know, moving as fast as we can. So that's another market incentive. About a year and a half ago, we were approached by the NAB Fast Road to look at reducing the cost of the implementation of HD radio technology. And we began a project that was known as the Embedded Exporter. This is taking basically all of the exciter core components and moving it over to a DSP platform. The first generation hardware was all deployed on Linux-based exciters. This allows for a radio station to move towards a DSP, you know, near instant boot time, and significantly reduce cost. I believe most of those exciters are probably about half or even lower than the original exciter cost. I want to say that they're in the $10,000 to $12,000 range now. So things are moving in the right direction. It's still, not an inexpensive proposition, but I think a radio station looks at the ability to have a total of four channels now in a major market, it would be a very difficult proposition to find any place in the U.S. where you could add four additional channels into a market for less than $150,000.
Okay, no, that makes sense. That's about the ballpark numbers I was using for several folks. How are things coming along with portable radios for the HD? I know there's a couple on the market. I've had a few to play with. Do you see more of them coming out? Is there, a roadmap to see portables that'll be available? Then Insignia, I know, has one, and Zune is another, and there's a couple of little I forget the name of that brand. It plugs into an iPod. But do you see more coming along so that sort of folks who are doing the FM and AM stuff can start to really push that portable side? Because in our market here in New York City, a lot of folks ask about the HD, and the car is one thing, but they like to take it with them. And some of the portable solutions that they've come across when they can find them really haven't been very portable. How's the chipset coming along with that?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head here. People want to be able to take the technology with them. They're finding out, how great it is in a car, and they'd like to be able to take it along. Right now, there are a total of five portable receivers: the Microsoft Zune HD, the Insignia Portable, which is commonly referred to as the armband radio. There is Seidel, which is a HD radio / navigation receiver. Then you mentioned the GigaWare, which plugs onto the iTouch and the iPhone and turns that into an HD radio receiver. And Sanjin is getting ready to introduce the first AM and FM portable in a small little package, and I think that's going to be a real big seller for them. So to answer your question, most of the technology improvements that were required for portable was really getting chipset consumption down, you know, below the 100 milliwatt region. And the closer you get it to 50 milliwatts, the more likely you're going to have that in more portable devices. Obviously, we want to be into cell phones. We want to be into all of the devices people carry. And we think that's the way to increase listenership. Certainly, being on 15 of the automotive platforms in 2010 is great. But we also want to extend that into the portable sector as well. Right now, on the automotive side, there's about 85 separate vehicles that have HD radio either as optional or standard equipment. Those of you who were out at NAB had an opportunity to take a look at the Ford Super Duty, which is coming standard with HD radio technology, and also the Volvo, which is another vehicle with standard HD radio.
That was great demo. I looked really good. I checked that out. That was fun. Hey, speaking along with portables, the Sanjian, do you know when they're looking to drop that into the marketplace? Third, fourth quarter?
I believe it's the third quarter.
Oh, okay. Very nice.
Hey, Jeff, it's funny. We spent 4 days 50 feet from each other at the NAB show, and I didn't get to get over into your booth because we were so swamped at the Telos booth. We did the podcast last week from the Telos booth, and you guys were just right behind us. So I did get to see some HD radios, though, at the CES show that I got to go to back in January, and met with a fellow from Ford who's designing the human interface for their screen dashboard display. And wow, this guy really gets it. He was showing all the options that they were putting into the screen now to show what's available up and down the band, and then of course deliver content, not video, but pictures, and of course other content like weather and sports scores, such as that. How do you see, but what kind of reactions have people had when they sit in a car and actually get to see what is available now, or what's can be available from broadcasters who want to send this kind of extra information?
Well, I think you put it very succinctly. He gets it. We're starting to see more and more implementations where the receiver designers are getting it. I think for all too many years, a receiver in an automobile was simply a chipset solution that was baked into an existing head unit design. But they really are working now on taking it to the next level, fully integrating all of the devices that people carry, whether it's an iPhone, an iPod, into the automobile, giving them a full control and interface. The HD radio interface is a logical extension of that, where all of the information is now presented to the consumer of all of the choices that are available on the dial. We're going to see electronic program guides being able to give us a greater forward look on the dashboard. It'll give us the ability to record content and store it locally on the receiver. So that if you're not available to listen to the radio at the time, you can record the content for later playback. And we're also now seeing a trend towards dual tuners in the receivers, where the one tuner can be actually tuned to the station you're listening to, and the other one can be scanning for more data and information. So as the cost of the implementation on the receiver comes down, more and more receivers are moving towards that dual tuner function, where they're able to deliver data content for navigational systems. And this will take the form of point of interest information updates, where you'll have gasoline prices available on the nav head unit. Perhaps a special will pop up as you drive by a restaurant. There's really no limit to what you can do with it, other than the broadcaster and the system integrator's creativity. So, I think that there's a lot of exciting days ahead for radio as we move towards these new features. Some of the stuff that you may have seen while you're at CES, we have the artist experience album art displayed along with the program service data for the radio stations. Both Clear Channel and NavTech are delivering traffic content with this point of interest information updates and traffic reroute based upon live data feeds. And then we have something new that we just showed here at the NAB, Active Radio, which is an alert system specifically designed for HD radio. This allows a receiver to scan the band looking for relevant emergency information. Even on battery-operated portable devices, it has a minimal on state that allows it to scan on about a 20% duty cycle. And with that, even with that low rate of sample, it's got about a 95% pickup on any of the emergency alerts. So even on battery-operated devices, in a sleep mode, we have a very high hit rate. It will allow receivers that are effectively off in a sleep mode to be woken up and deliver the information both in an audio format as well as a visual display on the receiver. So it's, you know, I think we're starting to move into some new areas that people haven't really fully observed as far as the capabilities of HD radio.
Hey, Chris Starr, why don't you jump in here? You've got some HD experience there in Milwaukee. What are you finding there now that that's a couple of years of experience with it?
Yeah, well, first of all, pardon my camera. For some reason, my white balance is going stupid. But from an in-the-trenches point of view, we've been running HD now in Milwaukee for several years. And as a matter of fact, we're just short of being short-spaced with a lot of stations in Chicago. And I found, first of all, that we really haven't had any problems with the digital carriers interfering with analog or with each other. And you know, we're able to get a pretty good lock on the HD signal pretty far out on the receivers. One thing that we have found, though, is the way you combine and the engineering in the antenna systems really makes a difference in how HD radio performs. For example, we found in early tests, if you don't model the antennas, if you're using two different antennas and doing combining that way, the space combining, that if you don't model the antennas correctly and have the nulls and fills landing in the same place, you can have situations where your digital carrier is so much more powerful than your analog and an analog null that you're wiping out your analog and vice versa as you're driving down the road away from the tower. So I think it's been a learning process from the engineer's standpoint as we implement this technology because everything's different and in a lab the stuff performs beautifully and out in the real world. It works pretty well, but there's a lot of things that we kind of learned along the way about, making sure that even things like the load to the dummy load. We had some situations where we were unable to fit the mask, and it turns out that there was a matching issue from the transmission line to the reject load when we're doing the high-level combining. So I think there's been a real good learning experience for the engineers in the field on how this works. And I think as a result, HD radio today is certainly performing much better than in its infancy when it was just first starting to get rolled out. But in terms of interference, and even at the current power levels and the proposed power levels or the approved new power levels, we really haven't seen the interference Armageddon that some people were afraid of, especially since Jeff will get into this a little bit, the receiver chipset and the receiver manufacturers, it's so tightly spec'd that the radios perform excellent, very well in analog and digital. So there really hasn't been a lot of issues there.
Hey, Jeff, some people in the chat room are asking about cost of HD radios now, and I know that the costs have been coming down. In fact, I've got an HD radio in my car that is several years old, and unfortunately, I really jacked up the front panel somehow. It's got a motorized front panel. I messed it up. So I've got to get a new HD radio in my car. Jeff, what am I going to expect to pay for a car radio? Not including the installation, but AM, FM, maybe CD, maybe iPod input, and certainly HD radio.
Well, you're probably going to have a hard time finding one without a CD. But yeah. The product range right now, on the low end, I think we're about $49 on the Insignia Portable. You certainly can probably spend as much as you want for a home AV system. But most of the automotive sets typically are in the range from about $79 on up to around $180 in a single DIN radio. When you get into the double DIN models, the pricing's between about $180 on up to $300 and something if you want a navigation display type. And So I think the good news is if you are in the market for an HD radio technology receiver for the car, you can easily spend as little as $79 and get a very high-performing receiver.
So someone in the chat room was saying, hey, I pay $7 a month right now for XM satellite radio. And one of HD's advertising claims is that, hey, you can get this for free. You can get more channels than ever before, as many as, 40, 50, 60 channels in a city, if you include the analog signals and the HD signals. So you get quite a few different channels of programming. Of course, they're not coordinated. They're not all run out of a central location like Sirius XM might be. These are individual broadcasters making individual choices about what they're going to broadcast on their HD signals, trying to get the largest audience or trying to serve a niche market that they think they can. So, but compare, $7, $10, $12, $13 a month for satellite with free HD, but you got to figure the time that it takes to pay off for the receiver, which may be more expensive.
Kirk? Yeah, I would argue that you probably got to buy that receiver anyway for satellite, unless you bought it in the car where it was built into your payments. But certainly the major selling feature of the technology is that there's no monthly subscription. You have much more choices. As we mentioned in the beginning, stations can carry up to 4 program channels now with the technology. That certainly at least opens the opportunity for a lot more variety in the market. And of course, it's up to the broadcaster to really live up to that claim, delivering content that is going to be truly unique and compelling. But that's, been radio's story all along. We need to keep doing that to be relevant.
And you hit a good point, because there are plenty of broadcasters who I think are guilty of not being there when they're needed on a local basis. Certainly, I've been through a couple of wicked storms in, say, Knoxville, Tennessee, tuned around the radio dial, and it's just music without any information. There are cases around the country, and I think listeners understand this, or actually they don't understand why their local broadcaster is ignoring local issues. But then there are other local broadcasters who are very responsible and are a great source of not only entertainment, but the local information that you might need, whether it's local scores, local news, or when bad weather breaks out, we'll break in, that kind of thing. Hey, Chris Tarr has a comment to pull in here. Chris?
Sure, just about the programming. For example, now in Milwaukee, we have got several different radio stations doing multicasting. So, for example, now before HD, we had an AC station, we had a Top 40 station, we had a rock station. Now we've got formats like blues and comedy, classic country, and of course, even Chris Tobin's company CBS, they've launched the Quadcast in Washington D.C. with 4 different sports stations on one channel.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I think there's a whole lot of new. New content coming out, and broadcasters are doing a pretty good job of trying to fill that void, and trying to come up with new ways to use these new channels. And again, unlike satellite radio, doesn't cost anything. Once you buy the radio, there it is. And here, I think I counted. I mean, we've almost doubled the amount of radio stations or content available in the market here.
I got to think that this is a chicken and egg, or has been early on in HD, a chicken and egg prospect for broadcasters. They may spend the money to transmit some HD channels, and then they got to figure out what to put on there. But what do you do when the number of receivers out there a few years ago was very, very low? But now we're getting quite a few receivers to where it's beginning to count what's going on with the HD. I think if Tom Ray were here, he would remind us that if his HD goes off or if he has a problem with it, he starts getting phone calls. And that surprised him the first time he did start getting phone calls about his HD. Jeff, what are you hearing from broadcasters about their listenership results with their HD channels? Can you maybe give us anything in terms of numbers or the ratio of HD listeners to the traditional station listeners? And what about incomes? Are broadcasters yet monetizing or selling commercials or having sponsored hours or anything like this on their HD channels?
Boy, there's been a number of very impressive success stories that I heard out at NAB, and I would encourage everybody who's listening to this podcast interested in that to talk with Rick Greenhut, who is in our marketing department. He has a video segment which has a whole bunch of interviews and presentations from small to large market broadcasters on their success stories with the technology in running multicast channels, how they found unique ways to position the station in the market. There's a radio station. Oh boy, I'm going to mess up here. I think it's called Radio U in Boston. That is just programmed to young adults, and they have had all kinds of success in positioning that station in the market where they couldn't do it with a full commercial facility, but they were able to do it using the HD2 channel and have had tremendous success. We are also seeing a lot of niche programming, Southeast Asian programming on Humdesi. That has been a huge success for a number of broadcasters who've aligned programming needs with their programming source. We're also seeing a lot of small town radio stations using the technology to deliver sporting events for the high school and junior high football during the seasons, where they don't want to normally fragment their existing music audience. It gives them the ability to bring them in, fill a need, and capitalize on it.
This is a good point, because I've worked for stations that were block programmed. You know, they'd be country music in the morning and sleepy at work music during the day, and then rock and roll in the late afternoon and early evening. They'd stick some news in there from time to time, the hospital report and the funeral home report. Well, that's the way radio was back a long time ago, when you had one radio station per town or a couple of them in small areas. So you're saying now people are putting this niche programming, like the local high school football game or hockey game or track meet, whatever it might be, something of local interest that they can sell sponsorships for, and that people will listen to hear, you know, their kid being talked about or winning a championship. They're putting these on their HD channels, and people can now buy a radio for well under $100 and have a listen to that. Yeah.
And as we talked about before, you know, this is radio getting back to its roots, doing what it does best, being local and being relevant.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to keep the conversation on the technology primarily. Certainly our chat room, you know, everybody has an opinion about programming and what stations are doing wrong, and very few comments about what stations are doing right. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit there are plenty of radio stations that have been lackadaisical about getting their programming right. And we can find a lot of examples of that, where local broadcasters haven't seemed to rise to the occasion. But it is local broadcasters that can meet this need, and plenty of them are. This radio station I'm sitting in right now, I'm the only guy here right now, and normally I'm not here, but all the employees here have weather radios. Some of them have direct lines and two-way radios to the local fire people and that National Weather Service. So they're in touch with, and they're a two-minute drive literally from the studio. So we've had people come up here in the middle of the night with tornado warnings and all this kind of stuff. Yes, that's all content that local stations should provide, and many of them do. But let's get back to the tech of HD radio. Jeff, can you do any more contrast between the HD radio technology that we have in the U.S. versus technologies that have been tried and in some cases failed in other countries, like DAB? Maybe contrast that with DAB Plus, and tell us a little bit about what DRM is. Give us a little brief overview of each one of these and how they're different from HD.
Okay. Well, I mean, all of the technologies in many respects have some very similar underpinnings as far as the audio coding that's being used now. The original DAB even has moved over to DAB Plus, which incorporates AAC plus SBR as its audio coding. All of the codecs, HDC included, are all MPEG family codecs. I think the unique part about HDC is that it has the ability to be a dual stream codec. We can break it into multiple components. Particularly on the AM, we have a core that is a 20 kilobit per second stream, and then we add an enhanced layer of 16 kilobits per second on top of that, to make a total of 36 as a stereo signal. So when the more fragile carriers for the enhanced layer go away, it results in a 20 kilobit per second, 15 kilohertz mono digital signal. So it's more robust. It gives you a soft failure, if you will, to a less a lower resolution audio stream. The so all the technologies are kind of moving towards MPEG families. The DRM technology for OF, it uses an OFDM waveform. They have one that can be spaced and basically live independently of the analog signal. It does require, if the signal is far away from the analog, to have a separate transmitter. The DAB technology is a technology that is primarily suited to large commercial broadcasters or public broadcasters, as they would probably be known in Europe, who have a lot of government funding. It is a more expensive way of deploying the technology with multiple broadcast multiplexes for these signals. They use many of them to cover an area as opposed to one large transmitting section. So for a public broadcaster in Europe, it is a good solution. But for the private and smaller broadcaster who can't afford to build the infrastructure necessary to do DAB+, HD radio and DRM technologies are more appropriate solutions for those. And I think, you know, the one thing that, if we can point out a benefit of HD radio, is that it's got more receivers in the marketplace. You know, there are about 100 product SKUs that are out there right now. That's pretty good. I don't know how many of the others have. I would imagine DAB Plus probably has a significant number of receivers, but certainly many of the others do not.
Gotcha. And DRM, this is something that I heard about a few years ago. It was primarily intended for shortwave, but it can be adapted for other technologies too. What's the deal with DRM? Are there some receivers out there for that?
I know of one. I don't know beyond that, quite honestly. You're right. It was originally a standard for frequencies below 30 megahertz. The standard was recently expanded at ETSI to include band 2 and band 3. Most of their focus lately has been on band 3 integration rather than band 2. So, you know, perhaps we'll be the sole player in the band 2 spectrum. Band 2, for those not familiar with Europe, is the FM band 87.5 to 108.
Ah, okay. All right. So I think Chris Tarr had another comment about the technology. And I was interested if you would help me understand a little bit more about exactly what OFDM is. Can you make an analogy as to what these carriers do and why indeed are they robust, especially in a multipath situation, which is what's needed for mobile reception?
Well, the redundancy within the sidebands primarily is what allows it to survive in multipath. I mean, the issue with a multipath is that you are causing reflections that are causing cancellations in parts of the spectrum. The signals are very robust to phase anomaly, and they have a lot of durability in the presence of that interference, because you've got redundant information both in the upper and lower sideband. There's not only spectral diversity, but there's also time diversity within that transmitted information.
Okay. Hey, Chris Tarr, did you have some other comments or questions? We're going to wrap the show up here in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, just real quick. With your with those different carriers, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're also using some sort of, I don't want to say Reed Solomon, but Reed Solomon-like randomization with the data streams, so that you can pick bits and pieces from either set of sidebands to pick out the best data. Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually called convolutional puncture pair coding.
Whoa! Say that again slow.
Convolutional puncture pair coding.
Wow. All right. What's that do for us?
Well, it allows you to combine, code combine multiple segments of channel information and gain a benefit by getting all of that information.
So in other words, whereas FM analog radio doesn't like multipath, HD radio loves multipath.
We survive very, very well in multipath. And typically the thing that you want to, you know, minimize in an HD radio signal is the amount of inter-symbol interference that occurs. And that whole concept of minimizing that interference is behind single frequency network operation for OFDM. That's a new feature that's in the latest load that allows the technology to be synchronized for areas where the power ratios are beyond 20 dB. And timing is very critical within the guard band interval of 150 microseconds.
Chris Tobin, you want to give us a last comment? You're in an area that's just full of multipath, and how are you finding HD to hold up in mobile reception there? It sounds like from what Jeff Detweiler is telling us, there is a lot of science behind what's being transmitted, and there has been a lot of research to make this work as reliably as it does, and even more reliably with more power that we can be getting.
Well, yeah, I would say that in the FMs, which we were fortunate to broadcast from one location in Manhattan, Empire State Building, reception distance has been excellent. No complaints. Most of our audience, when they call up and comment, it's been positive. Our AM stations in the market, because we're scattered geographically around the city, reception's been pretty good. Because we've got one of them is a directional station, it tends to be a little annoying at times when the ground connectivity changes, parameters in the antenna array shift, and you know, once in a while we have some complaints from folks on the fringes, but for the most part it's been working really well. I actually had a question for Jeff. He mentioned to me at the NAB show about the new AM a new AM codec. Did I have that right?
Well, it's actually a configuration of the MA1 mode. The
that was it.
Secondary and tertiary carriers can be turned off. The analog bandwidth can go out to a full 10K. Modulation can run at any limit you want legally. And I had to put that in there for the attorneys. The codec now can be optimized for stereo as discrete stereo, parametric stereo, where stereo information below 5 kilohertz is eliminated. And it's basically a more efficient way of sending stereo with perceptual coding. And it can also be sent in mono. For stations that are not transmitting stereo information, where the additional bits are used for artifact mitigation in the codec.
Is that configuration now available for broadcasters, or is it still under test?
We released it to the manufacturers at the end of 2009. They are now integrating it into their products, and I would expect to see it probably before midsummer.
Oh, excellent. So now I happen to be a user of the Harris encoding system, the Dexstar product line. Is it just a software change manipulation, or do I have to change out hardware for my particular case?
My understanding is for all of the manufacturers on the original Gen 2 platforms, it is just a software upgrade.
Excellent. Okay, great. That's what I was just curious about.
Guys, thanks very much for all participating here. We're going to have to wrap everything up. Have a number of questions in the chat room. And, hey, Jeff, you and I need to communicate about some URLs for white papers and explanations of how HD radio works. We'll want to know about the tech, the science behind this. And then if you have some papers, resources we might look at about how the business model is going and where broadcasters might be putting it to use now and in the future. Also, some people have been asking questions about commercializing HD radio and how many commercials they're running. The HD radio listening I've done, haven't heard any commercials, but then I don't listen every day. So I'd like to put some of these things in the show. Give us a quick overview right now before we wrap up about the commercial aspects of HD channels.
Certainly, there's no restriction now for a broadcaster to run commercials on the program streams, the supplemental program streams. Originally, there was. The FCC removed that restriction. But the broadcasters are really trying to get the word out on the multicast channels and allowing that to be virgin spectrum, unspoiled by commercial content for the most part. So it's a very enjoyable listening experience to the HD, HD2 and HD3 and HD4 channels right now.
Cool. Jeff, thanks for being with us. We'll hope to have you back again sometime and give us an update on receivers. Yeah, a lot of us spend a lot of time in the car, and so it's nice to have a cool receiver in there to listen to. So you can listen to your iPod if you got a podcast to listen to, but if you just want to hear some good programming, you don't know what's coming up next. You know, I get tired of the same 700 songs on my iPod, so sometimes it's nice to hear a local voice and hear some new music. Jeff, thanks for being with us very much. Chris Tarr, thank you for joining us from Milwaukee.
Thank you, Kirk. And one final thought on HD radio. Remember, folks, it's evolution, not revolution.
Ah, so it may take a while longer.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris Tobin, thanks for joining us from the greater Manhattan.
Oh, you're welcome, Kirk. No problem. Anytime.
All right. And Jeff Detweiler, I appreciate again you coming and being with us on fairly short notice. Appreciate the sacrifice you made to be on the show tonight. Thanks a lot.
Kirk, my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. And for listeners, thank you for listening. Remember, you can check out the show and the show notes at thisweekinradiotech.com. The show should be posted just a few hours after we get done with it. You can also subscribe to the show on in the iTunes store. Just do a search for Tort. There are two shows called Tort. I think you can find ours pretty easily. Subscribe to the right one. It'll download to your computer automatically. There's also an RSS feed available on the front page of the website, thisweekinradiotech.com. Thanks a lot to Eric Lanigan at the Twit Network for engineering tonight, and also to Burke for getting things set up. We appreciate it. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another Tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.